Thank you very much. Is this thing working? You can hear me in the back. Good. This is a small example of something I've taken to calling it DS, for Dempster Shafer. That's the term I'll use. Glenn Shafer, who is the other initial, uses a somewhat different language, but it's all the same thing, and we go back and forth with different, a little bit different terminology. So there are three or four little examples like this that we're trying to develop. So this is current work, and it's not finished by any means, as you will see. It's background, yes. Don and I have a very common kind of background coming through what was originally math and physics. I think in my years, 1948-52, as an undergraduate, it was called MPC, Mathematics, Physics, and Chemistry. That was kind of a novelty, I think, adding the chemistry. So we had a rather large group in the first year, and it narrowed down, and I narrowed down into mathematics. My father died in my, what we now call senior year, so I didn't kind of go ahead into any graduate program. I stayed another year in Toronto, and I studied mathematics again. And I did go to one class by Don Fraser, and he started off with the space and the sigma algebra and all the rest of it. And that was the end of that. So that was my introduction to statistics. But somehow, I did keep up. I thought I was going to get a PhD in mathematics, and somehow in 1954 I had a sort of change of heart and decided, well, that pure mathematics really wasn't for me. And I started out in life insurance, but that turned out not to be good. And then I had an opportunity to go to Princeton, which I did in 1954, to start on math stat with Sam Wilkes and John Tukey, I guess the same people who had big influence on Don. I had read the previous year the textbook by Mood, which I thought was a little peculiar. I still think frequent statistics is a little peculiar, maybe answering the wrong question. I remember being at a meeting probably 30 years ago. It was in Atlanta, and the British Don, John Hammersley, was introducing Neyman in a huge lecture hall. And somehow or other, he said, well, he always thought Neyman's statistics was about giving the right answers to the wrong questions. And that's kind of been my attitude all along, to some degree. But I certainly respect the quality of the mathematics that is being done in the other tradition. But my tradition really grows in some sense out of Bayes. It's a kind of a big extension beyond Bayes. And really, the driving force behind it is Fisher. So what I'm talking about here does have real connections with Don in two ways. One is he did a lot of early work, because in the 1940s, I think especially, and then later there were wonderful things being done in this non-parametric area by people like Abraham Wald had a neat little paper in the Annals, I think 1943, and John Tukey extended it to doing multivariate non-parametric things of that sort that were really very interesting, and I think should be featured probably a little more now than they are. But what I'm doing here is going way back to the very beginning, doing simple things in the roots, explaining what they have to do with the fissure in particular. People, no, this is an aside, people do chat about their what they learned, and I, like Dave Brillinger, remember Dave's background in 1950 when the math department was up in the tower in University College, and Sam Beatty was the head of the math department. They got him out of that job because, and made him chancellor, I think, didn't they? Something like that. And there was a classroom up there that Dave told a story about falling under a table. I can picture a long classroom, kind of long. There's a long table, and there were maybe half a dozen students, or a dozen, I don't know. And we were listening to Coxeter up at the blackboard, teaching us about some version of non-Euclidean geometry. And we didn't fall into the table, but there was a time when four of us, sitting one next to each other, figured out how to play a bridge game under the table. And this seems to go on quite a lot. I dare say Coxeter knew about it, but he, you know, didn't pay any attention. I mentioned Coxeter because he had a big influence on me. I like to think geometrically, as does Tetuki and so on. And the thing, the multivariate things I started my career doing were very much concerned with going straight from geometry to computation. So geometry and computation are both driving things, and mathematical analysis is kind of a necessary evil, but you want to. The real fascination is with uncertainty and its quantification, and in particular, as you'll see, this DS theory is based on the idea of having a third kind of probability, not just a probability that something has happened and one minus that probability that it didn't happen. There's a middle range. I used to call it an upper and lower probability. And the difference between it is what I now call the probability of don't know. So the key thing is to bring in this new concept of don't know and attach probabilities to it. If you go through a week and listen to verbal expressions from anywhere, we're bombarded with these things, especially from the media and from friends and from family and all the rest of it. How many times in a week will you hear the phrase, I don't know? Probably several hundred. I never tried to count them. And they don't mean that they know they're attaching a probability to it, but this kind of theory we're talking about, I now try to emphasize the fact that you don't know. I discovered sometime in the last year and a half, because it's quoted so often, a paragraph from something that John Maynard Keynes wrote in, I think, 1937, where he was responding to people commenting on his famous big and unreadable book. He clearly understood Bayes. You know how you compute. In order to make a decision, you evaluate every option, every way you think you can do it, in terms of expectation, posterior expectation, given some data. And he explicitly said, although not in quite these words, that there's another concept there. There are just things that you don't know, that you cannot assign probabilities to. So that's a concept that comes from him. It also appeared in the work of a well-known economist who was kind of a founder of the economics department at the University of Chicago. A man named Frank Knight wrote a thesis about 19, I don't know, 17, 18, it was published as a book in 1921, and it went through many editions. So Keynes would have known about it. He featured this, exactly the same idea of don't know. So it's been around kind of a long time. And both Knight and Keynes were saying that you can't get to this concept with the regular Bayesian theory. So in a way now, that's why I'm going beyond it. I mean, once you get the idea of going beyond it, you can do all kinds of things, because you quickly get into this notion of don't know, meaning you don't assign distributions. You can treat measurement error, a ball of some kind, as just saying that you don't know where the truth lies in that ball. So the whole of the logic of scientific analysis can be extended to include these kinds of things in the probability analysis. I really think that it has possibilities, and I'll come to that as I go through my slides, possibilities for complex systems. So Paul Edison is a very bright young statistician, got a PhD at Harvard a year ago. He's been around, and he's going to Seattle to the Hutch, the Cancer Center there, since his real interest is in statistical genetics, that sort of thing. James Ong is a Harvard undergraduate who has kind of taken an interest in things like this. So let me proceed then with the slides. I'm trying to get on to the next one. What do I do? Press return. There we go. That's just the abstract that I put in, so you probably have it in some document. Here's what I think of as defining my talk. Not too many people know about this DS theory. It's a little bit odd. A month ago, we had a I didn't say we, but Thierry Deneux, who's the editor of the journal, International IJAR, International Journal of Approximate Reasoning, I think is kind of a spark plug. It used to be Philippe Smets in Belgium, but he died, unfortunately. So they put together a conference workshop, 3 days. First day was short courses, and then papers in Brest, that organization, engineering university in Sieta in Brest. There were 130 people there, 70% roughly from France. So that's really the center of theory related to DS at the present time. I think there was one person from England who worked for Eads, the big aircraft company. One person from Canada, a graduate student from Laval, who was going to spend a month there. In addition to Glenn Schaefer and I, we each gave our lectures on these 2 days. The Americans were just three. One, a student of Xuanhai Liu at Purdue, and a couple of people that Glenn had known 20 years ago. So it's not known. This theory basically is unknown in statistics. It's not unknown in AI, but in AI it, you know, occupies a little corner somewhere. But it has a lot of important applications, and it turns out that mainly these have been in engineering fields. Okay, so I'm introducing it. It'll take a bit of time to explain it. And I'm going to apply it, going back to where Fisher really introduced this idea, to nonparametric inference about a continuous univariate population distribution. And then explain an idea that came up in conversations with Xuanhai Liu, he has a different take on it. He's a little more frequentist than I am. But it's this notion of robustifying an analysis through weakening the model. Of course, Bayesian inference is a particular type. And the original idea that Fisher had in his fiducial thing was to weaken Bayesian inference by getting rid of the prior distribution, which is everybody's big bugaboo. So that's where I'm going. Still getting this thing going. Right, there we go. One thing that I have been pushing in thinking of applying the theory is that first you set up what we're calling the state space model, the state space extended to include, say, things moving through time. So successive draws would be successive things in a big vector. So make it really complex if you need to, and don't worry about being unable to assign probabilities to the big uncertainties. Then you put these probability models essentially on margins of the state space, and then you do an analysis that is based on some very simple operations. So I am working, and I'm happy to work with anybody who wants to, on these little examples, some of them having to do with non-parametric modeling, as I'm going to talk about now. There are others that are more on robustifying parametric models. The multiple testing thing, where now you can test thousands of things and you try to pick out what means something. An even harder problem of getting to covariances. Say, people were talking yesterday about, well, can we really do much with current technologies when the number of variables greatly exceeds the number of observations? Statisticians maybe were taught, as they said, to keep away from that. And it's true, I think the existing technologies don't do very much for you. But I actually wrote my PhD thesis, which had nothing in it, and left Princeton after 2 years on that exactly that topic. There are a couple of publications, one in the Annals and one in Biometrics. But it still is a hard thing. You should be able to say something about each of the, say you've had 10 observations in a 100-dimensional multivariate normal population. You should be able to say something about each mean and about each variance. But it's pretty clear that if you think about variances, there are certain dimensions where you can only put an upper limit of plus infinity unless you bring in other prior information, which you could do. So a DS-type analysis saying that you don't know it's where it is in some range above a lower limit, that's the kind of inference you might have in response to this difficult problem. But just applying simpler, weakened DS things is an interesting area to me. And you know, there are things just waiting to be written up that I may or may not get to. So there's a different attitude. You don't start thinking about, at the end of thinking about the data, you think about everything you might want to know. And even the simplest thing, like tossing a coin, gets hugely complex if you really want to explain it. So make the SSM big enough to capture what matters. So you might start, I'm interested in climate change, have been for 15, 20 years, but more and more now, since it's getting to be such a public issue. Say the world economic system, monies and the currency exchanges and all of these again are throwing the whole field of economics into some kind of a turmoil that the sort of simple, the stochastic model approach to it isn't going to give the answers that people need. So what is this DSPM, the probability model? It, mathematically, it's just a probability distribution over subsets of the possible true state, where possible true states within the SSM. The night of the SSM, there's one true state, you don't know where it is. So you have a probability distribution over a margin or a partition of the space. And we call that the mass distribution. In Schaefer's 76 book, he called it the basic probability assignment, or BPA. So those are two terms that are used interchangeably. And what it does is it represents your allocation of formal uncertainty as to which state of the SSM is the true state based on evidence that justifies. So you're going to assign a lot of these DSPMs, and each of them is supposed to be based on some argument or evidence that supports it. So when I put you in quotes, I'm emphasizing this is really a theory of personal probability. The DSPMs are meant for inference, that's the interpretation. Essentially, posterior probabilities given data. So there are many of these things, and I'm going to talk here about where you have a univariate sample, x1 to xn, and it's being, think of it as coming from a population that has a unknown cumulative distribution function, and you're going to observe the x's and find an inference about the f of x. So where are these DSPMs coming from? Well, we're just going to forget anything like measurement error and say we're going to get data, which is lowercase xi. So for each of these n things, you have an actual numerical value of lowercase xi in this example, keeping everything very simple. So you have n of these things that put probability 1 on a slice inside the DSPM. When it comes to the statistics as a sampling hypothesis, there's an assumption that there are n uniforms, uniformly distributed variables. You would call them random variables, but they aren't random. We don't think of them as random. They think of it as something is your evidence of the sampling about the sampling process is these n draws from a uniform. So I leave the word random. Uniformly distributed variables means that they have a distribution, and it's a simple uniform distribution over the n-dimensional cube. Okay, so now we have these n things that assign probability 1 to subsets, and this assumption that assigns a uniform distribution on the cube to the capital UI, which are defined, anything you can define from the original variables in the SSM are part of the SSM. So you're applying these little u's to the big u's. And now the theory works. It's a computational theory. We call it a calculus. If you have something, a DSPM on a big space, you can project it down. It's essentially the same operation as marginalizing probability theory, except instead of dropping down to points, you have sets that drop down to sets. But in this theory, you can go the other way. You can take something on a margin, and this is typically what's done. In all the examples I've given so far, it's what happened. So you can project up, because it's sort of like set on the margin becomes a cylinder set in the big space. So these are operations that are just very natural. In terms of personal probability, if you adopt something on a space, you logically implies something on a margin, and something on the margin logically implies something in the bigger space. But the key thing that drives it is this rule of combination, which is like the independence rule in ordinary probability theory. And I define it in words here, as I'm doing everything in this talk. Suppose you have two of these DSPMs and you think they come from independent sources of evidence. This has got a bunch of sets, Schaefer called them focal sets, that carry probability. The other one, same kind of thing. So take each set on this side and intersect it with one on that side and multiply the probabilities. And then you're going to have to accumulate, because there are many, usually many sets here and here that give the same intersection. So you add up the probabilities, integrate them over that set, and now you have another set of probabilities on the SSM. And what is going to happen a lot, usually, is the intersection of a set here and a set here is empty. So a lot of these combined probabilities don't mean anything. And so the ones that do no longer add up to one, as probabilities have to, and you can do some kind of renormalization. There's also a probability that is kind of thrown away because it corresponds to the products of the sets that have an empty intersection. That probability is called conflict. And it's a funny concept, because typically in Bayesian inference, the conflict, if you're dealing with continuous variables, the conflict is one. You only get an epsilon amount on the things that really intersect if you combine the likelihood and prior, which is an example of this operation. Boolean combination is part of it, because that's where you put probability one on particular sets. And you can make examples where ordinary independence in probability theory is an example, combining prior and likelihood, and Bayesian inference and Boolean combinations all over the place. Whenever you write down an equation that doesn't have anything random in it, you're making a Boolean assumption. So there's a standard, what I call a standard protocol. You set up the SSM, you get independent ESPMs, you up-project to the full SSM, because when you combine, logically you combine on the full space you're working with, and then you down-project to make inferences about particular things you're interested in. And I stress here that it's basically a personalist theory. Jimmy Savage introduced the word personal probability sometime around 1960. He stopped talking about subjective probability, since it gets you into trouble. But the idea is that all of these examples, the typical things that statisticians get into when they want to quantify issues of uncertainty, it's based on judgment. Different people can disagree. There's no, as there is with Bayesian inference, there's no agreement about what the answer is supposed to be, but there are a lot of guidelines and better way. You can argue a lot about what's a good way and so on. So we have this notion of PQR inferences, where P is the probability 4 and Q is it's the total mass that must belong to a subset. Those probabilities are all committed on one side of the assertion being true, and there's other probabilities that all belong to the subset that is means false. And then there's an intermediate set of masses that kind of straddle the subset and its complement, who call the probability of don't know. So instead of P plus Q equals 1, you have P plus Q plus R equals 1. So there's different language being used. I used upper, lower, and upper probability that are in the new PQR language. P is the lower probability, P plus R is the upper. And you only need two of those things because they have to add to one. Schaefer called the lower and upper belief and plausibility. Different terms are used interchangeably. I prefer the PQR because it puts a focus on R, which is a species of uncertainty the Bayesian inference is unable to address. And I already mentioned it seems to be a link to Knight and Keynes. And Keynes, those guys would be saying, I told you so about the current economic mess, because, you know, the people in the financial and macroeconomic field talk about risk all the time, risk, you know, systemic risk and all. That to me means they understand a lot about the SSM, but there is a lot who don't know in there, which is one of the sources of the current troubles. Anyway, I'm going back to early history. Fisher talked about fiducial reasoning. The paper was published in 1930. I suppose it was around for a few years before that. When I would go to England long ago, I would meet an elderly statistician, J.O. Irwin, I think his name was, who was very proud of the fact that Fisher had approved his talking about fiducial probability at some conference before Fisher published it. So it came at the same time as Neyman and Pearson's famous little paper on the power of tests and so on, that Fisher kind of from then on always disagreed with those guys because they were just talking about mathematical properties and procedures. But what VS is doing then from one point of view is saying we're giving precise concepts and rules that cover many of Fisher's examples. One of the things that Fisher couldn't do was deal with actually multidimensional things. Very well, if it was a two-dimensional parameter space, you could always figure out different choices of pivotal quantities to invert and so on. Another thing that he typically would do is, like, if you had a sample from a normal population, you wanted to estimate mean and variance, he would first reduce the data down to the sufficient statistics, and they had the same number as the parameter space, and so you could make some kind of an inversion. In this theory, you don't have to do that initial reduction. And in simple models dealing with, say, a sample from a normal with non-known mean variance, you can actually do the thing in the high-dimensional SSM and, in effect, get the same kind of answer. Sufficiency is a concept that comes from outside the theory here, and you don't have it to rely on, and logically it's cleaner not to do so. So some of Fisher's procedures had ad hoc things in them, and he just endless trouble over that. So a numerical example. He just kind of threw off a little discussion of what became essentially the drop in the uniforms. I'm going to tell you where he did that. He wrote a nice little paper in the 1939 volume of Annals of Eugenics, an obituary of W.S. Gossett, the famous student who discovered the T-distribution, I think, from Monte Carlo, essentially. And Fisher, of course, then derived it mathematically. And somewhere he traced in Fisher, in the student, maybe in correspondence between student and Fisher, that student said that if you had two observations from a continuous population, the probabilities are a quarter, a half quarter, that the true median lies in between the left of the observations, between or to the right. So with probability, which Fisher's calling fiducial probability, one half. Now these things, of course, do have, a lot of them have frequency interpretations, and mathematical statisticians picked that up, and it became the holy grail of nonparametric inference. But you can also, just going back to the beginning here, look at this from the DS perspective and start going down a rather different track. So he explicitly introduced the idea of the uniform distribution associated with the values of the CDF at the observed x's. So the Fisher's notion is, well, this is the way you should think about your uncertainty. You can only say something about the joint distribution of the CDF values at the observed values, but you can get a lot of information out of that. So here is setting up the situation, and the claim here is that essentially, without worrying about mathematical details, you can assign PQR to any kind of statement you want about the cumulative distribution function. How do you do that? Fisher, of course, didn't have any R greater than zero. He didn't have a PQR idea. So I'll start off by talking about, suppose I give you an interval from A to B on the line, and then you get a set of n observations on the line. What can you say about the f of B minus f of A, which is the fraction of the population between A and B? If you're uncertain about that, you want to say something. When I say you, this is the personalist you. So what is it you can say? Well, here's a very crude drawing where I put five observations on the observation axis, and I imagine that I'm going to deal with this uniform distribution on the five-dimensional cube that you can, or you can think of, reduce it to the ordered values. And I'll be working primarily with the ordered values of the little u's. So what Fisher said was, if you take the five ordinates, unknowns, but you know, monotone, non-decreasing, take the five ordinates of the unknown f of x, they are distributed like, this is your posterior distribution, is that those values are like draws from the uniform. So this is an imaginary, just hypothetical set of draws, and I'm making the picture. Now the claim of the DS is that you can make statements, you put A and B anywhere you like, say between the first two and the last two. So you want to know the fraction of the population that's in there. You have to face the notion that even if you did know, say from a particular set of u's, you did know these five ordinates of f of x, you would still only know that the actual f of x that you want to make statements about is inside these red, somewhere inside these shaded areas. So this is where the don't know is coming from. And it's not hard to think which of these draws from a uniform would guarantee that the f of b minus f of a was greater than or equal to any particular value you want or required to be, and then there would be others. And it turns out that those values are essentially things dealing with the intervals of beta distributions, because you go between the first, so if you're working with A between the first two observations, you're working with a corresponding value of f of x. between the first two order statistics, and all these issues for finding P, Q, and R are just simple consequences of what you see in this picture. So we started to do a few sort of numerical examples. Suppose I've got a sample of 100, and I'm essentially looking at the interquartile range of the data between 25th and 26th and 75th and 76th. You kind of expect that that's going to hold about half the population, but what is your uncertainty about that? Well, you look at these inner and outer ranges of the little u's, ordered little u's, and I picked a particular value in this example, 0.58. It's actually coming from thinking about sampling error. It is, if you were thinking about 0.5 and you estimated it, its standard deviation is 5. So this is 1.6 standard deviations above 0.5, which is close to the 1.645 that we all know on standard normal distribution that gets 5%. So this example should have something like, these are probabilities being on the outside. You should have something like 0.05 and 0.95. And what turns out is kind of like that. This is just my crude simulations. You can do 100,000 draws of ordered use of a sample of 100 and, you know, kind of in like an eyelash, a flash. So here is instead of 0.05950, which is what maybe Fisher would be thinking, or DS or ordinary frequentist confidence intervals would be thinking. And it turns out that 0.0365 lies in the don't know category, and it comes partly from the 0.95 and partly from the 0.05. So you can do this for this 0.58, of course, for every example. 0.58 is down on the right somewhere where you get essentially an upper and lower, and you can do it for every value of P, some, I think, just for a crude subset, enough to kind of give you the idea of what the unknown R is at different values of the F of B minus F of A, where again we're looking essentially at the interquartile range. Yes. Sorry? Okay. Okay, I'll skip along. Everybody's getting hungry. So now I'm coming to the main point, and I think that's okay. What I'm thinking here is that it's dangerous to use this 9505, or the other one that I showed with the R in it, because people can see clusters in the data. And if I'm offering two sides of a bet, one thing that I think is crazy about the frequentist world is all its long-run frequencies, but it's always, you don't get to choose the side of the bet. If I'm a broker and I'm allowing all kinds of interval gambles, I don't want to do it. So what I can do, and since this is all in an early stage of investigation, I don't want to go too far with it, I can weaken in such a way that these uniforms, I draw a set of uniforms, but then I think of all the ways, if I rotate them around the circle, to have the origin at each of the observed ones. If that gets me a much bigger much bigger set that the DSPM lives on, and it's kind of an interesting problem combinatorial thing. You can a difficult one. It's looking like at the maximum of subsets of the sums of the gaps between the uniforms. The uniforms are a very interesting, simple thing. They're just uniform over a simplex, but and it's also symmetric among all the gambles. So you you're saying, well, let's say we don't know which of these things is doing, so it distributes the possibility of clusters of the U's being the explanation of clusters of the X's, because it allows those a priori to be anywhere in a kind of a shifting position. So now you get different values of PQ. I say there? Yeah, the ones that were I showed you before are very different now. You've only got little p of 0.3626 of being inside the interquartile range. So it's a much weakened kind of inference. And maybe you want to bet that way. So here are the two plots that correspond to the previous ones. I have another set of examples here where I apply the same weakening to the thing that Fisher actually wrote. It was a quote from Fisher, sample of six, the chance that the population median lies outside the observed range is only 0.3125. And then he does that for a sample of nine outside the, except for the outer two, 0.3906, and the chance of 12 observations. These things he's calling chance, he sometimes calls fiducial probabilities. Even in this paragraph, fiducial appears. And I could, you know, long argument about, you know, the validity of these things for making bets. The chance is only 0.386. He chose these examples because they were, I think, the first values under. And yeah, these are just simple computation of tails of coin flipping the fair coin. And you can do the rotation scheme on these, and the probabilities are weakened. The n equals 2 case you can do analytically in a flash, and it's a quarter, three-quarters. Three-quarters goes into R. But for the larger samples, as they start to move up, you are getting these values, the 0.89 that was 0.95 in the simple-minded case. You're never sure in any of these examples. We don't know the math yet, but even a sample of a Monte Carlo of 100,000, you never get a case where you're sure it's outside the interval. But you're 80.8287 sure in the n equals 12 case that you're inside, and the rest of it goes to don't know. All right. Just one comment here about fiducial inference. There's a complaint which says that variables cannot both be independent of the population and independent of the observations. In DS land, this criticism has no force. For example, in the nonparametric model, if you should acquire prior evidence that specifies f of x, that's one DSPM. If you're comfortable with the UI being ID uniformly distributed, it's another representation. The data, yet a third piece of evidence. And there's nothing that says these can't all be independent, because they only become operational once you observe the things. So let's assume they're all independent, and then we can do sampling theory, traditional, or we can do fiducial inference and regard it as DS inference and get the answers you want. Why do people get really upset? Well, there's this notion that the world is random. Call it here the random world hypothesis. Nature determines a stochastic model, generates data by a random process. The statistician's job is to perform uncertain inference about the random process. And people are so fixed on this idea that they think it's ridiculous that you could think of the observations as independent of the random mechanism. Because the random mechanism is used to create the observations. Independence is nonsense. In this world, however, we're not concerned about this random world. When you think about it, the world is a lot more complicated than just the randomness that's represented in a statistician's model. I'm not opposed in any way to all the wonderful work that goes on in the stochastic applied probability type field. Listening to Larry made me wonder a bit whether, in fact, its computational geometry was perhaps actually a lot of those people who may be thinking in terms of Boolean uncertainty, where you just know, don't know where something is in a ball or something like that. Second thing, I just wanted to emphasize that these little examples are fine and sort of fun, and maybe even contribute some basic understanding to uncertainty, but the real idea is to try to get to these, you know, PQRs about how much the temperature of the world is going to increase in the next 20 years. So that's it. Thank you.